From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. University of Colorado football coach Gary Barnett was suspended this week for his comments about a female player who accused a teammate of rape, the latest blow to an already troubled football program that was in the hot seat over recruiting parties that allegedly had sex, alcohol, and call girls. And today, Colorado police say they are investigating the sixth sexual assault allegation involving a football player. Colorado is just the latest school to be rocked by such allegations. The NCAA is scrutinizing several college football programs for their recruiting practices. Tonight on Point, unsportsmanlike conduct and scandal in big-time college athletics again. We begin in Denver with the latest on the University of Colorado story. David Magoya is an investigative reporter with the Denver Post and has been covering the story since its beginning. I asked him about today's developments.
Well, the latest is everybody's trying to figure out how long Barnett's going to hold his job, even though he's on administrative leave. That's one idea. But today, the Boulder Police Department released another report involving an alleged sex assault of a female in which two CU football players are being looked at as potential suspects. I use that phrase very intentionally because that's how the police are describing it. It's a different sort of case because the woman here has been unable to identify her attackers. However, witnesses have been able to put these players and the woman together the evening of the attack, which happened back in the summer of 2002.
And it's believed they are both football players?
Well, it's known that they are, but whether or not they were with her in her home that evening where the attack allegedly took place is something they're still looking into, apparently. But that would be the sixth case of a sex assault investigation involving a football player that's come to light in the last couple of weeks.
David, what did Coach Barnett say exactly that led to his suspension?
President Hoffman made clear yesterday that their decision to place him on paid administrative leave was based on two sets of comments, both discernibly different times, the most recent of which were comments that the coach made the day before regarding former place kicker Katie Nida. Katie went public in an article in Sports Illustrated under Rick Riley's byline where she said not only was she harassed and given some troubled times during her time on the football team back in 2000, but she was in fact raped by a fellow teammate. She wouldn't provide the name. And the coach, in response to that article, basically spent most of his time talking about Katie Nida's talent or lack thereof. So precisely his words were to the effect that she was awful, she was not a good player, and didn't make the team. And President Hoffman was very upset by that, saying the coach should have spent his time paying attention more to the concern of another sexual assault allegation rather than attacking the woman's talent or lack thereof in his eyes. The second set of comments was from a police report that came public yesterday in which it's alleged, the victim alleged, that she had a personal meeting with Coach Barnett and two other persons, one of whom was an athletic department official, that we're not sure who that was yet, and which Barnett allegedly told the woman that should she pursue criminal charges against the player, the coach would back that player 100%. Those combination of comments is essentially what set in motion where we are today, and that's Coach Barnett sitting at home.
I want to go back to one of his comments when he said that Katie was not only a girl, she was terrible, because that seems to have some special resonance. You know, football players have been told for years when the coach wants to chew them out, you play like a girl.
Sure, that's one of those things I guess we remember hearing as kids. The football environment, especially the college football environment, is not one where women are, I don't want to say welcome, but it's not typically the place where we see them. Katie Nida was the first woman to score a point in Division 1A football, as well as, I think, the second woman to suit up, at least on the sidelines, and then make it into a game. Katie was in a very hard situation. She was a fairly good high school kicker, as I understand. She nailed 83 of 87, I think, field goals or extra points or whatnot. So she was fairly well known. But the coach inherited Katie in the sense that Rick Neuheisel, the previous football coach at CU, asked Katie to try out for the team, gave her a spot on the team. When Coach Barnett showed up in January 99, he sort of felt obliged to offer Katie an opportunity to try out for the team. She made the team, and then, of course, thereafter she left the school and didn't make the team, according to the coach, because it's so awful. So this is really a woman walking into what's typically been seen as a man's environment, And if she doesn't play like one of the boys, then she's not going to be treated like one of the boys. And Katie made that clear. She wasn't. She was ostracized, and then, in fact, as she details, was raped.
And do you think it makes any difference that the president of the University of Colorado is also a woman, or would any college president have reacted the same way?
You know, I would like to put Betsy Hoffman much more above the issue of male or female and her decisions as a matter of gender. I think in this specific instance, the groundswell of support seems to be that she did the right thing, regardless of whether she was a male or a female. The chancellor of the school, Richard Binney, a doctor, agreed with that. The athletic director, Richard Tharp, agreed with that. So I don't think President Hoffman would have done what she did any differently if she were a man.
As you know, this afternoon, a couple of Coach Barnett's players came forward and described him as an upright and honest and moral man. What was his reputation prior to this?
Well, I spoke with a player yesterday from the coach's days at Northwestern University in the early 90s, mid-90s, and he was emphatic that the coach was an honorable man, a straightforward man. Gary Barnett came from a culture at the University of Colorado when he was an assistant coach under Bill McCartney. Bill McCartney, as your listeners may be aware, was the founder of the Promise Keepers organization, a very devout Christian organization. And Barnett was part of that atmosphere of Bill McCartney, then went off to Northwestern to be head coach and then came back to CU. The principals at the university made it clear, at Colorado that is, they hired Barnett specifically because he was such a disciplinarian, he was such an upstanding and honorable person, and someone they believed could turn the program around, which they felt, and the NCAA also felt, had run into some trouble under the previous coaching administration. So Coach Barnett, at least till today, was viewed as someone that was very much in control and keeping things in line. However, these depositions and lawsuits that have been filed against the school and some of the players specifically note that Coach Barnett wasn't aware of a lot more things that people might have guessed he either should have been or would have been.
Do you get the sense that he did know about these things and chose not to take action, or that he really was not aware of how many incidents there were that had occurred?
Everything seems to indicate that, as the coaches has said in his depositions and publicly, that many of the issues dealing with recruits, whether recruits were offered sex or taken to topless or strip joints, those were things that he's not aware of. In fact, he cannot control what happens to the recruits between the 9 o'clock hour in the evening till 1 in the morning, which is the curfew, and that's the time that he's most nervous by his own admission. But this latest police report in which the sex assault victim, says she met with Barnett and he offered treatment to her, as well as said he'd back this player 100% should she pursue criminal charges, that's really the first documented evidence suggesting that the coach was aware of many more things and may not have done something about it. So for the first time, we have the first solid question as to whether or not he may have known a lot more than he's letting on. So we're certainly exploring that.
Well, David, thank you so much for filling us in.
It's my pleasure.
David Magoya is an investigative reporter for the Denver Post. He spoke with me from Denver. What do you make of what's going on at Colorado and other football programs? Are you shocked or do you just shrug? How far is too far for schools to go to recruit top athletes? Is this the price we pay for our obsession with sports and winning at all costs? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me now from Bloomington, Indiana, is Murray Sperber, professor of English and American Studies at Indiana University and author of several books, including Beer and Circus, How Big-Time College Sports is Crippling Undergraduate Education. Welcome, Murray.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And with us from Miami, Florida, is Michelle Kaufman, sports reporter for the Miami Herald. She wrote a richly detailed piece about college recruiting in Sunday's paper that shows a disturbing trend across the country. Welcome, Michelle.
Thank you for having me.
Murray, I want to start with you and just ask, which of these cases strikes you as the most egregious?
Well, I guess the Colorado one is, because it's been going on so long. I think what your reporter in Colorado didn't tell you is that under Bill McCartney, although indeed he was a fundamentalist Christian and Barnett was an assistant, there were lots of scandals, tremendous scandals, as there were under his successor, Rick Neuheisel. So in some ways, the Colorado one is disturbing, but there's one in Florida, and possibly Michelle could talk more about it, the Willie Williams case, where this USA Today All-American, one of the best high school players in the country, was wooed by a number of schools and kept a diary of going around to these schools. And he was flown on charter planes. He was given absolutely lavish, sumptuous meals, put up in deluxe hotels and all of this. Now, after he signed with Miami and did not sign with the University of Florida at Gainesville, he was charged by the Gainesville police with various offenses and such. But I guess the most interesting part is just what was normal procedure, how these recruits are wooed and won. And such. And I don't think the public is really aware of this whole side of college sports and how really egregious it is. No other student, students with 1,600 on their SATs, you know, potential math geniuses and such, at best, they get a bus ticket to the school. And no one else except athletes, particularly in football and basketball, are wooed this way. And, of course, one of the things, USA Today had a good article today about hostesses at these schools. There are various organizations of young women, students at the school, who host the recruits and such. And at Florida, it was called the Gator Getters for a long time. And at Austin, University of Texas, the Texas Bells and such. But now, you know, they're not instructed to give sex to the recruits, but often after the official tour ends, that's a sort of unspoken part and such. And these groups are often sponsored by the athletic department. So this has been going on a very long time. It happens that the Colorado one, because of the laws in Colorado, actually, and because the first three women who complained took it to the federal courts, and therefore the case was open to media scrutiny and
such. All right. Well, speaking of media scrutiny, let's bring Michelle in and continue with the story, Michelle. You found several cases across the country, and perhaps you might want to start in Miami where you are.
Yeah, well, it's really the idea of the using women and booze to get guys to come to college. It seems like it's been going on a long time. Like Murray mentioned, these hostess groups, which had names like NC State had the Stately Ladies, and Miami had the Hurricane Honeys and the Gator Getters in Gainesville. And while it wasn't supposed to be, you know, it's not sexual in nature, and they are officially just ambassadors for the university, they, you know, clearly are using female companionship as a way to try to woo a, you know, hormone-raging 17-year-old boy to come to the college. And at some of the schools at Georgia, they wore black tight dresses and pumps, you know, to give campus tours, which doesn't really seem like the most comfortable clothing to give a campus tour. They have now changed. A lot of these groups have changed. The University of Miami group is now called the Kane Connection. In Gainesville, they're called the Gator Guides. In Georgia, they're now the Georgia Guys and Girls, and they actually have a co-ed group that is giving the campus tours now to the athletes. So I do think that that's changing a little bit, but just the idea that part of the recruiting process is using girls to get the guys to come to college. And then the alcohol, basically what happens is colleges have exactly 48 hours per NCAA rules.
Actually, Michelle, I'm going to have to ask you to hold the thought because it's really a good one, but we have to take a break. So we'll pick up with you when we come back. We're talking this hour about big-time college football recruiting, big money, big headaches, and big questions for schools and coaches and athletes and fans. Why isn't it enough for colleges to promise a degree, never mind the sex, love, and rock and roll? Do you sympathize at all with the coaches who are under the gun to land top recruits? Are we just making conversation till the stands fill next season? where you can join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about the unfolding scandal at the University of Colorado and a disturbing trend in college football recruitment across the country. Did Colorado behave especially badly, or was it just the one to get caught? Where do you draw the line between selling a school and going too far? Is it time to blow up the whole college athletic system and start over? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're talking with Murray Sperber, who is professor of English and American Studies at Indiana University and also the author of several books, including Beer and Circus, How Big-Time College Sports is Crippling Undergraduate Education, and with Michelle Kaufman, sports reporter for the Miami Herald. And Michelle, I had to cut you off earlier. You were making a point about how these schools only have about 48 hours to recruit. And in all fairness, we should point out it's not the colleges, or sorry, it's not the coaches who are taking these kids to nightclubs, right? It's fellow students.
Right. It's what it is they have 48 hours. Most of it is supervised by administrators, coaches. But then at nighttime, what they do is to give the kid sort of a sense of what it's like to be a student athlete on that campus, they have a student athlete host, and they spend about 5 hours with that person from dinner time through 1 or 2 in the morning, whatever the curfew is. And during those hours is when these problems have been happening. It's sort of the after hours, 5 hours where the coaches are just sitting there crossing their fingers. A lot of coaches I spoke to for my story use that same phrase. You know, I cross my fingers during those 4 or 5 hours because they are then in the hands of other student athletes, and they're going to places where apparently the student athletes hang out, which apparently is not only nightclubs, where they're underage, but also strip bars. At the University of Minnesota, a student-athlete was recruited there, had accepted to go there, and then changed his mind and went to Nebraska because during his recruiting visit to Minnesota, he was taken to a strip bar, and he felt very uncomfortable and felt peer pressure from the teammates, and he decided not to go to that college for that reason. So also the University of Michigan had a scandal in the late 90s, where an athlete who ended up going to Michigan State was taken to a Detroit hotel suite where strippers were hired, and they had a big party with alcohol and strippers, and then the car rolled over on the way back to Ann Arbor. Nobody was hurt, but the story made big headlines, and it's gone on at many campuses around the country, Alabama, even South Alabama, smaller schools. So it's something that's sort of become endemic to college football and basketball, and it's not exclusive to the University of Colorado by any means.
Murray, is part of the problem here just how colleges fill their teams? Because clearly there are only so many great players out there. Are there more problems then as they're just trying to make their numbers?
Well, yes, I think that's part of it. I do want to disagree with Michelle about one point. I think the coach's official line is we cross our fingers, we hope for the best. But you're talking about type A personalities who are control freaks. Gary Barnett's a perfect example. I remember him at Northwestern in the Big Ten. And there aren't that many players. There's something like 16, 17 coaches for 125 players. So 1 to 10. And it's the coach's full-time job. So I've always been very skeptical of coaches' disclaimers. Oh, we never knew about it. These kids are wild and such. They control every hour of an athlete's day. And
so you're saying the coaches could put an end to it if they really wanted to?
Absolutely, they could. As far as it being endemic, Michelle is absolutely right. And part of the problem is every team wants to win. Colorado tied for the national championship in 1990 in football and wants to be back at that height. But the problem is Colorado high schools are not turning out a great number of students to start with. It's a small population state compared to Texas or California, say. And also, you need blue chip players, and you need blue chip players who can make it through your school. And that is a very small pool nationally of high school seniors, and they tend to go to schools. If they're from the Midwest, they often go to Ohio State or Notre Dame or you know, schools in their area. So Colorado always has to go out of state and get players who are not taken by, say, USC in Southern California or University of Texas and such. And often these are players who, if they have the athletic talent, they're academically and socially marginal. And over again, there's scandals at Colorado because of these kinds of players. But you can't win without them. So it's a kind of pact with the devil.
Michelle, I know you're going to have to leave us in just a minute, but let me ask you whether you see a real difference here between someone who's underage going out and getting drunk during one of these recruiting trips, which has probably been happening since the beginning of time, versus what's happening now. Is this different? Is this something new?
I think the only thing that's new is from what I've been writing for 18 years in sports, and what I have found is that the young athletes now, there's a lot more exposure at a very young age to these athletes become stars earlier. They used to become a star in college. Now they're becoming stars in junior high. You know, there's the internet. There are all kinds of recruiting gurus that are out there running websites, and there's cable television, and, you know, there are recruiting shows on cable TV now, and the shoe companies have gotten very involved. Nike and Adidas are targeting kids in junior high and giving contracts to high school coaches, and it's just everything has trickled down to such a young age that by the time a kid is 17 years old and choosing where he's going to go to college, he has not one hand out but both hands out, and he's already wearing gold chains and driving fancy cars, and you wonder where all this stuff came from in the first place. But it just seems to me that everything, and the athletes that I spoke to who were recruited, let's say, in the early 80s, they said that, yes, there was drinking and stuff when they went to their recruiting visits, but there wasn't the kind of debauchery that we're talking about now with hiring strippers. That seems to be a very common practice now, that college athletes hire strippers for the recruiting visits to entertain the recruits. And this kind of thing really wasn't, it doesn't seem like it was that bad even 20 years ago. And I just think that what is considered entertainment and acceptable, just in general, our society has just sort of lowered the standards. And I just think it's a combination of a lot of elements, and also the amount of money that is at stake here. You know, college athletics makes a lot of money. And when you talk about why the engineering student with a 4.0 doesn't get recruited the way that Willie Williams, a guy who was arrested 10 times, was recruited, is because Willie Williams could bring a lot of money to the University of Miami or the University of Florida, whereas the engineering student maybe ultimately would be a famous, you know, something, a famous engineer, but probably would not bring millions of dollars to the university. So it's a huge problem, and I don't really see how it's going to get better anytime soon.
Well, Michelle, we thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Michelle Kaufman, sports writer for the Miami Herald. And Murray, let me pick up on something you were saying a moment ago about how for many of these students, this is a real opportunity. They might not be so academically strong. So let me pose a question, which I know is going to sound very innocent. Why isn't the promise of a college diploma enough?
Well, I think Michelle described it well in that our culture has become so sports obsessed that if you're a good athlete, you're identified from a very early age, and your parents begin to consider you their lottery ticket. And for the huge bucks that professional sports can bring, of course, they don't consider the long odds, which are as long as winning the 649. I mean, million to one, actually. And so I think the idea of the value of a college education, I know Harry Edwards, the black sociologist who was at Berkeley for many years, went around to high schools in various parts of America and would tell kids, you know, your chance of playing in the NFL or the NBA is a lot smaller than your chance of being a brain surgeon, for instance. And but kids, because of the glamour of sports on TV and the media hype and such, very much want to do that, get channeled into it, go to special summer camps. And as Michelle pointed out, they're stars from high school, from junior high on, and therefore they look at college, actually, as minor league training. It's a kind of accident of American history that professional football and professional basketball did not develop minor leagues. The college game was there before and was tremendously popular. So to be in the NBA or the NFL, you've got to go through the college version. So they see it very much as minor league training. An athletic scholarship is a one-year contract. It's renewed every July at the behest of a coach for athletic ability. So the idea of getting an education for many athletes, especially prime athletes, becomes very secondary to getting minor league training in their sport.
All right, let's go to our phone lines now and hear from some of our listeners, find out what you think about all of this. Lisa's on the line from Oconomowoc, Wisconsin. Did I get that right, Lisa?
That is right.
Okay.
Very good.
Thanks. What's on your mind?
Well, I was kind of chuckling at this whole topic because way back when in the late 80s, I guess, I went to a private school in New York, Division I hockey. That's the only Division I sport they had. And hockey was a very big deal there. It was they were national champions a couple times in the 80s, trying to retain that status. And at the time, the male-female ratio of the school was 6 men to 1 woman. So you're trying to bring in top Canadian junior hockey players to this program. So myself and my girlfriends, sorority girls at the school, engineering students albeit, were very often hosting recruiting parties, off the books, recruiting parties for these boys when they would come through. It wasn't unusual that the whole party was all of our sorority sisters, the hockey players, and these recruits. Kegs were funded by the hockey players. And, you know, the hockey team is maybe about 25 guys. So it would be hard for me to fathom now, you know, 15 years later, that the coaches didn't know that we were doing this.
Well, Lisa, did any of those parties ever get out of hand?
Depends on who you're asking, I suppose. My landlord might say so. typically the way they would go is the party would happen. It would be 8 o'clock until midnight. Bars in New York close at 4, so everyone would be loaded on the campus shuttle, which shuttled everyone to downtown. And then all the bouncers at the bars would let the recruits in with the hockey players to the bars.
So no ID checks at the door?
I'm sorry?
No ID checks at the door.
No, not typically. The average hockey player coming out of Canada is often 20 years old already, so they're already legal to drink in Canada. So this is just the norm for them. I think that it's expected when they come to visit these schools that they are going to drink, they are going to do what they do in Canada. Honestly, the stories of what goes on in Canadian juniors hockey is pretty atrocious when it comes to women and bars and so forth. But to expand on it, I ended up going to graduate school at Notre Dame, and I ended up TAing a lot of athletes, student athletes at Notre Dame, and the treatment there is very different in that there's so many Division I sports, there's so many Division I athletes. So I think that I saw a contrast between the two schools. Notre Dame is a school of mostly dormitories, very few students living off campus, very, very strict bar scene. So I did definitely see a contrast between the two. But now my nephew is a freshman football player at Madison, and certainly his recruiting stories brought back memories of when I was in college. So,
all right, Lisa. Yeah. Well, we appreciate the call. Thanks for sharing your experience with us. I want to bring in Robert Bakken now. She's joining us from Coral Gables, Florida. She's a professor of history at the University of Miami and is also on the board at the Center for Research on Sport and Society. Hi, Robin. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
What do you make of all of this? And is part of what's happening here the fact that women are now more involved in sports at this level? You know, obviously, 20 years ago, there was no issue about women on the football team.
Right. Well, I think that's almost a secondary issue. I think what's more prevalent is the idea that football, as a spectacle, has really dominated collegiate life at many institutions for about the last 100 years. As early as the 1890s, there was discussion about how football was becoming the preeminent sport and, indeed, the preeminent aspect of all elements of social life on college campuses. And so what role would women play, particularly at these new co-educational universities? And it was very clear from the start, as early as the 1890s, that while there were athletics programs for women, and of course women becoming more increasingly involved in athletics, that because football was so dominant, women should be actively involved in some way in promoting football. So, for example, at the University of Chicago, which, believe it or not, at one point had a very strong football program, women were some of the first fans of the game. They were people who created the cheers for the team. The football team would often host parties in the women's dormitories to get women interested in the spectacle of the game. And so there's a very long history of women serving as kind of sideline fans, sort of pep ralliers for the team. And obviously that has, you know, led historically down the line to today, the Hurricane Honeys and whatnot, so that there's a very clear connection between football programs and the utilization of female students as boosters or recruiters for top players.
But how did we get from the time when the big lure was cars and club memberships? Why has it now become sex?
I think that's a particularly interesting and troubling question. I mean, part of it seems to be, you know, Michelle raised this point about general trends in society at large and in culture at large. You know, one of the issues here seems to be this question of entitlement and the fact that, you know, as Michelle and Murray pointed out, many of these athletes become stars when they're in junior high school. So they already have a sense that they are treated differently, that rules are broken for them, and that they don't have to sort of abide by the same kinds of standards and regulations as other students. So that by the time they're being recruited in college, there is this real sense that they have lots of things available to them that other people do not. And some of that might be, you know, lobster and steak dinners, and it also might include the company of women. And, you know, I think that, I mean, if you look at professional athletes, for example, there are a number of scandals going on right now among professional athletes and their access to women and their treatment of women. And I think it's part of a larger kind of sporting culture among collegiate athletes as well as professional athletes, this general sense of entitlement that when related specifically to the issue of women and sex, suggests to them that this is just something that based on who they are and what they've achieved, they're entitled to.
Well, some very interesting points. We're going to continue our conversation in just a moment after we take a break. We're talking this hour about unsportsmanlike conduct in college recruiting and coaching and the behavior on campus by players and others. It's a big problem that's playing out right now at the University of Colorado and other schools across the country. Do you really want to know how your favorite team recruits its athletes? And if you knew, would you still support the team? Are lobster dinners and call girls just the price that schools and fans have to pay to get the best athletes? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harris, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about big-time college recruiting practices and abuses in the wake of the unfolding scandal at the University of Colorado and reports of recruiting abuses at other schools across the country. We're speaking with Murray Sperver, professor of English and American Studies at Indiana University, and with Robert Bakken, professor of history at the University of Miami. And not surprisingly, a lot of you want to get in on the conversation as well. Let's go to Lexington, Kentucky now, where Jeremy's on the line. Welcome to the program, Jeremy.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to comment on a point that I haven't heard made so far in the program, and that is that a lot of people are pointing fingers at coaches, college administrators, and others. But I really don't hear anybody talking about the complicity of the female ambassadors in this problem. It seems to me that some of these female ambassadors must be sort of encouraging the kinds of misbehavior that we've been hearing about tonight in this program. And I'd just like to hear what maybe your other guests have to say about that.
All right, Jeremy, thanks for the call. Let's start with you, Murray, on that one.
Well, I think that's blaming the victim, finally. Indeed, you know, people participate in various behaviors, and many women are attracted to athletes because of the glamour and the fame and such. But no finally means no, or very quickly means no. And I think many of these women, Sports Illustrated has a good article in the new issue about the Colorado scandal. And many of these women were unfortunately quite drunk when the rapes happened and such. And the rapes essentially were they felt they were being overwhelmed and they said no. And the athletes in no way heard no. So indeed, people do participate in behaviors, but I think, you know, no means no. It's really that simple. And apparently the district attorney in Boulder sees it very much that way. Mm-hmm. And so they're, you know, that's why she's going to bring various cases.
And now to Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Dooley's on the line. Hi, Dooley.
Hello, hello. I am interested in discussion about how complicit presidents of universities and indeed the boards of the universities have been. And I think of the example of St. Bonaventure College and the basketball. And do your panelists know what happened up there recently with them losing? I guess they've been suspended for a year or so, and coach quit, and president of the university quit, and board member committed suicide.
Mm. Robin, are you familiar with that case?
Yes, I'm familiar with that case. And again, it's one of several cases that that have been ongoing in terms of recruitment violations. I think presidents are in a tough spot. I mean, clearly, for example, at the University of Miami, when Donna Shalala became president of this institution, she created some widespread changes. She meets weekly with our NCAA compliance officer, for example. And she's very clear about graduation rates being important in terms of our football players, for example, having high graduation rates, offering summer school, for example, to our athletes. I think that they're walking a fine line because obviously no president would want to hear of these kinds of activities taking place under their watch. I think the coaches have a much clearer and direct line to the players. You know, maybe Gary Barnett did know, maybe he didn't know. But, you know, it's very clear that that he's entrusting his players with the care of these recruits. And there's probably some knowledge of the general type of activity that goes on. As far as presidents of universities, though, I'd be hard-pressed to say that there are too many presidents that you would say are complicit in these sorts of activities. Again, they want to recruit students. They want to put on a good face. But at the same time, here, for example, at the University of Miami, we're aware of the history of recruiting violations that cost us scholarships and whatnot. So I think presidents are trying to be as careful as possible and at the same time still remain as competitive as possible.
And, Murray, I wonder, do you think that society is really fed up with things like this, or is this just a temporary story that gets all of our attention, and then things are going to go back to being pretty much the same as usual?
Well, many years ago, I worked as a sports reporter, and I remember an old grizzled veteran saying to me, he had covered college sports for many years, and he said, build them up, tear them down. Build them up, tear them down. So this is a slow time in sports. February is a very slow month because football's over, baseball hasn't started, March Madness, the NCAA men's tournament doesn't start till March, and NFL or NHL and NBA playoffs are months away. So if you notice, historically, the scandals, you mentioned the St. Bonaventure one, it occurred a year ago February. And so the media has to feed the machine, particularly in this day and age with the 24-hour news cycle. So it, you know, feeds upon these events and it titillates the public. But The public also loves March Madness. And when the tournament starts, you know, there'll be great hoopla and all of that. And certainly Miami football creates huge hoopla and such. So it's an ongoing cycle. I think one of the problems, though, is it does hurt universities more than ever before. It was mentioned before how much money these sports make. And indeed, football and basketball do make money for schools. However, almost every athletic department in America, including Miami's, at the end of the year, it's red ink, are losing money because of the tremendous costs of all the sports the NCAA requires you to play just to play football and basketball. And that is hurting the university. USA Today's front page lead story yesterday was about how money is going from the academic side of the university to make up the deficits of athletic departments, and particularly at a time when universities are rattling the tin cup. So, indeed, there's always been this cycle of build them up, tear them down. But I think the stakes are higher, and hopefully more faculty will become involved than ever before, and that'll give the president some backbone to really get control of college sports.
All right. We're getting short on time, but I do want to take one more caller. Christy's on the line from Sandwich, Massachusetts. Hi.
Hi. How are you?
Good, thanks.
I think it seems to me that this is a rather ironic situation. Here we are in a day and age when women are rising to the top of corporations and they're proving themselves to be more intellectual contributors to society. And at the same time, we have certain segments of society that continue to downplay women and degrade them and treat them as, you know, kind of a entertainment for males that are successful in other ways, instead of continuing to promote women in athletics and make them more successful in that area.
All right. We appreciate the point, Christy. Thanks for calling. And Robin, let me ask you, you look at the big picture from your position. Is there a big solution in your view?
Well, there are a number of scholars and former college presidents who have written extensively about this topic in just the last couple years. Books with the name of, you know, Reclaiming the Game, College Sports and Educational Values, by Bill Bowen, who is a former president of Princeton. Jim Duderstadt, former president of the University of Michigan, has written about this topic. I think that in the last couple years, as there has been in the past, there's a fundamental reassessment of the relationship between higher education and athletics. And, you know, people are asking the tough question of how athletics, particularly revenue-generating athletics, relate to the overall mission of higher education. And so a number of scholars and former presidents have come up with potential solutions, or at least programs for possible solutions, things like ending college scholarships for athletics, for example, making scholarships be solely need-based rather than based on athletic performance.
All right. Well, we'll have to leave it there, Robin. Sorry to have to cut you off, but thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Robin Bakken is professor of history at the University of Miami. Murray Sperber was also joining us from Bloomington, Indiana. Thanks, Murray.
Thank you.
Professor of English and American Studies at Indiana University. And earlier in the program, we heard from Michelle Kaufman, who joined us from Miami. She is a sports writer for the Miami Herald. And you can continue the conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. This is On Point. Katie Nida's accusations that she was sexually assaulted by teammates while she was a place kicker at the University of Colorado are being met with a variety of responses. Coach Gary Barnett dismissed the allegations and called Nida a, quote, awful player. Many fans of the Buffaloes say she's lying. Colorado resident Tina Grigio vehemently disagrees. In this radio diary, she takes umbrage with those who want to write off a rape allegation because they think Katie Nida just has an axe to grind.
Here's a quote from Big Buff Buff, a diehard University of Colorado supporter so outraged by Katie Nida's allegation, he felt compelled to post the following to a fan message board. Here's an idea. If a man rapes you, report it. raping people is not normal. If a man raped you, it is likely he will rape someone else. See? You can protect other women from getting raped if you report that you were raped. See? It kind of works that way. Just a hunch. But I think she may be fibbing. Just a hunch, Big Buff Buff. But I'm guessing you know a lot more about football than you do about rape victims. I'm speaking generally here. I don't know what happened 4 years ago between Nida, the only woman ever to play for the CU football team, and a fellow teammate any more than any of you do. Big Buff Buff thinks she may be lying. So do others of memorable nomenclature at netbuffs.com, who are castigating Nida as a liar and a spoiled brat and a lousy kicker who didn't belong on the team anyway. She had a grudge against Coach Gary Barnett, the chatter goes, because he cut her from the team, so she seized the opportunity to blindside him. As long as we're choosing sides, I have a hard time believing that Katie Knight is lying. More to the point, I don't believe that her story can be discounted simply because she is coming forward now. I waited 20 years. I never even told my sisters, and I was living with one at the time. I rationalized what happened to me quicker than Barnett could say, "I'm not leaving." Why wouldn't Katie say anything right away? She answered that herself. She was scared of what might happen. She knew Barnett didn't want her on the team in the first place. Why wouldn't Katie say anything right away? Start from the fact that many women never report rape or sexual assault. And how do we know that if it's not reported? Here we tiptoe among statistical landmines. Probably the best numbers produced on this subject come from the federal government. Every year, twice a year, the U.S. Department of Justice surveys a sample of 76,000 people. In 2002, there were an estimated 248,000 rapes, attempted rapes, or sexual assaults against victims over the age of 12. Of those, only about half were reported to police. 69% reported they knew their assailant. Of those, 57% call their attacker a friend or acquaintance. The validity of the survey depends, in part, of course, on the honesty of the answers, and many groups working with rape victims believe these numbers are low. I wondered whether any good stats on false reports of rape existed. The short answer is no. The best estimates attributed to the FBI vary between 2% and 10%. Which brings me to my bias. Statistical probability aside, I have a hard time believing Katie is flat-out lying because no person of reason would step out and expose herself to such tremendous public scrutiny and scorn. They are not people of reason, you might argue. They want money, revenge, attention. Such things have happened. But ask yourself, does Katie have more to gain here than she has to lose? It is incredibly hard to say in public, "I was raped." So powerful is the stigma. Even if you've said it to yourself 100 times, saying it aloud makes it real all over again. It forces you to look in the eye what you have been avoiding, sometimes successfully, sometimes not, for months or years. Saying it aloud may mean having to name the attacker. It may mean seeing him again in court and listening to people turn and attack your judgment and character. It may mean dealing once and for all with what happened. And many people, for many reasons, would simply rather not.
Tina Griego is a columnist with the Rocky Mountain News. She lives in Denver, Colorado. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Imada, Julie Jopp, Chris O'Connor, Virginia Prescott, John Roberts, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog. We had help tonight from Michael Garth and Darren Manoogian. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Gail Harris, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.